Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Voice of Olympus, I'm proud to bring you Living Hellenismos with Tony Merzwicki. But before we begin, a quick legend of Hercules, or more specifically, a legend of Hercules' father. Between my mom's mythic bedtime stories, a very thorough Greek parochial school education, and my own lifelong passion for the mythology of my ancestors, the tale of Father Zeus's ascent to the throne of Mount Olympus is already very much a part of who I am. It is firmly etched on my neurons and comfortably nestled in all the strata of my psyche. As the story is already so familiar to me, I was very pleasantly surprised by the delight I experienced while reading Zeus and the Rise of the Olympians by Ryan Foley. Framed as classroom instruction during the reign of Zeus, with students occasionally asking questions to clarify enigmatic elements in the original stories, the graphic novel covers the reigns of three Hellenic pantheons, the Primordials, the Titans, and the Olympians. Ryan's well-crafted words convey the saga of divine succession powerfully and effectively. His selection and use of source material is brilliant, and his own creative spin greatly adds to the enjoyment of the account. The unique personalities and motivations of Uranos, Yi, Kronos, and Zeus move the story forward and greatly invest in the outcome. Although the ending isn't exactly unexpected, if you're familiar enough with ancient Near Eastern variants of the tale, it nonetheless took me totally by surprise when I finally arrived there. Very well done, Ryan. As Zeus and the Rise of the Olympians is but one book in Campbell's mythology series, the contributions and creativity of the editorial team shine more brightly with each graphic novel you read. Great work, guys. I'm looking forward to experiencing and reviewing the other tomes in the wonderful series, as well as interviewing some of the gifted people involved. Onwards. And now, without further ado, Tony Merzwicki and Living Hellenismos. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing well. It's been a very eventful day, as some days sometimes are. But here I am, and I'm looking forward to hearing your and Jan's conversation.
Indeed. We're very fortunate to have Jan Pepper on the show today. We had her on the show twice before, August 2021, where she shared her insights into Aphrodite, and also in October 2021, where she discussed Demeter and Persephone. So we now have Jan back to chat about Zeus and father archetypes in her forthcoming paper titled provocatively, Who's Your Daddy? The Special Role of Fathers, Zeus and More. But first, let's have a summary of her background. Jan Pepper received her bachelor degree with a focus on sacred mythologies from DePaul University and a master's and PhD in mythological studies and depth psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institutes. Her dissertation, titled The Psychology of Home, an Archetypal Study of Relationship to Place, includes a chapter on Greek goddess archetypes as experienced through our mothers. Jan has facilitated rituals and sacred ceremonies since the early 1990s. She has presented twice at the Parliament of World Religions, numerous times at the American Academy of Religion, and co-chaired the AAR Western Region Goddess Studies Unit. She founded the Joseph Campbell Mythological Roundtable of Ketchum, Idaho, which, like her ritual circle years prior, met monthly for 3 years. She continues to present on various topics, including the goddess and gods in popular culture, mythology and the hero's journey, and understanding home. Jan, thanks for making yourself available and coming on the show. How are you today?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hopefully there won't be any volume issues today. So, Jan, I've read the draft version of your forthcoming paper, and I really enjoyed it. You began by discussing the pairing of the Sky Father and Earth Mother, or the archetypal father and mother. You provided examples from various cultures. However, I wanted to focus on the ancient Greek cases, specifically Zeus, Apollo, Hermes, Dionysus, Perseus, and Heracles. So could you possibly give us a little bit of a discussion on those?
Yeah, sure. I think just to back up only slightly is just to emphasize how we see this pairing of a sky father and earth mother over and over again in sacred mythologies and religion. So you see it in Native American tradition, specifically the Navajo tradition, where changing woman is impregnated by the sun god and gives birth to Monster Slayer, who, like his name says, goes on to cleanse the earth of monsters when he goes in pursuit of finding his father, the sun god. Jesus in Christianity, same kind of thing, just a different twist on Monster Slayer, right? He cleanses the earth of evil, right? And then is reunited with his father in the sky. So you see this kind of over and over again. Zeus is interesting for a number of reasons. But of course, we know he's the grandson of Gaia and Uranus. So Mother Earth and Father Sky. He also, he has a lot of, the thing about this pairing is that, Mother Earth provides the child, or, the mother archetype always provides the child with home. First and foremost, she is our first home. Right. She is the language of home. She keeps us at home. She nurtures us. She protects us. She gives us sustenance, all that kind of stuff. Then the father archetype, by virtue of being in the sky away from home, plays the role of pulling us out of home. So he inspires us, he pushes us, he leads us, he teaches us the skills to exist in the world outside of home. And because his existence in this other world is intriguing and mysterious, as we begin to mature, we are, curious, and we want to go out into the world to see what that's all about. What is it our dad does, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about archetypes more if you want. But so when we get back to Zeus, for the most part, that is the role that he plays. He's actually this very benevolent father. We know he's a rascal, right? he gets a lot of females pregnant. But he's actually really benevolent. So the first thing he does is he does have a number of sons that will join him by his side in the pantheon, right? And a father that is showing us the shadow side of the archetype is more competitive and cruel and abusive and domineering and egocentric. So there's no way that the shadow archetype of the father would share that kind of power, right? But Zeus is very, very clear how powerful he is. He is the father god. He is the primary god. The Greek religion really was Zeus religion, and everything else fell underneath that. And so in that capacity, he has Apollo. Apollo joins him in the pantheon. Hermes joins him. Dionysus later joins him, and even much later, even Heracles. But I guess before I even get to that, I want to say the thing about the father archetype pulling us out of home is it requires us then to go on a hero's journey in order to mature, become adults, and then fulfill our destiny. So even with these gods, Zeus's sons, we see the same thing happen. You know, Apollo kills the python. Hermes, well, you know, Hermes is just fantastic in so many ways, period, right? Like he's not even a day old and he steals Apollo's cattle, right? It's not exactly the same kind of hero's journey, but he, from the very beginning, just declares that he is divine. And this is, you know, it's a great story because, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm talking really fast, but for anybody that doesn't know the story, Apollo is essentially born in a cave. Once again, Hera, Zeus's wife, is jealous of this offspring that's going to happen because Zeus had an extramarital affair. And so Apollo's born in a cave, and Hermes says, yeah, no, not quite. I know I'm divine by birthright. And so he goes and he slaughters Apollo's fabulous cows. And he actually makes a sacrifice to himself. And in that way, you know, declares that he is divine. And you know, even Apollo, Apollo goes on to be the sun god. So then he continues this celestial father motif, right? Ends up having Orpheus, who descends into the darkness, comes back up, you know, following his father. But that sense of being the benevolent father, we see that particularly with Dionysus. And I guess you could say even with Athena, although it's not, he's not as conscious about it with Athena, but Dionysus, born of Semele, who was a princess, and he loved her very much, but, you know, she kind of gets tricked into saying to him, to Zeus, I want to see you in your full form. I want to see you really as the god that you are. And unfortunately, Zeus had already promised he'd do whatever she asked of him, and so he has to show himself. And, of course, it incinerates her because no mortal could look on a god in their true form and survive. But Zeus goes on, takes the unborn child out of her womb, which is Dionysus, and sews Dionysus into his thigh and allows him to gestate there until he's mature enough to be born, right? So kind of born, taken out of the womb, first born, and then born out of the thigh. And then he is nursed, you know, taken away to be nursed by the Maenads until he grows up and all of that. But to think of a father, you know, holding the child in the thigh, and the thigh is such this place of power, right? The thigh is the groin area, the source of male power, and yet that's where he holds them. So that's a pretty beautiful little thing there, right? What else am I missing that I can tell you about Zeus and that archetype?
You mentioned Perseus in your paper and Heracles.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, you may know more about Perseus than I do. Perseus, I'm sure everybody knows Perseus as the one who is sent on the mission to cut off Medusa's head. And he does manage to do that. So that there's his hero's journey. And his mother was, again, mortal. She was a princess, I'm pretty sure. Oh, I know. The great thing about Perseus, you just got to love this, is again, all the ways in which Zeus will appear, and he has, you know, so many famous stories of how he changes his appearance in order to seduce the mortal interest. And yes. In this case, he turns himself into a shower of golden rain,
mm-hmm.
Which again is just evoking, you know, the rain obviously comes from the sky, but you add that little golden touch and there you are as that celestial light, right? And that's how he seduces Perseus's mom. But I actually am not, I'm embarrassed to say, I'm not that familiar with the whole story of, I know Athena helps Perseus and that, but that's not one I have under my belt. Can you share it?
I think you've pretty well covered the bases.
Okay.
But, I mean, the whole point is to talk about how all this works into archetypal figures. That's kind
okay.
of your specialty. So,
well, then let me mention Heracles. What's really interesting about that story to me is how a benevolent father can be hands-off. You know, the father archetype allows us to figure this out. The father archetype will give us skills that we need, teach us what we need, and then say, hey, figure it out on your own. So we really see this with Hercules. Again, Hera, jealous. So no sooner is Heracles born that she sends, you know, these vicious snakes into his nursery to kill him. But Zeus ensured that he had strength. So even as a child, even as an infant, he's able to kill these snakes with his bare hands. And, you know, he continues to grow up, be pretty healthy, do all that kind of stuff. And then Hera comes along again and zaps him with a kind of insanity. And he ends up killing his wife and children, which is horrible. And then he, in order to pay penance for that, is charged with those 12 famous labors. And again, his father Zeus gave him exactly what he needed to be able to complete those labors, the strength, the persistence, the determination, and he does it. And so much so, you know, eventually then is rewarded. He does find love again. Unfortunately, his wife is extremely jealous and, you know, gives him the shirt that is laced with the blood of the Minotaur. Is that right? The Minotaur? When Heracles slays it. And so
it's a Hydra story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You're absolutely
okay.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks.
So then, you know, he puts on the shirt that is supposed to be a love token and it actually burns him. He cannot take it off. And he's, you know, so it drives him mad. He throws himself on a funeral pyre. At that point, Zeus steps in and says, you know, you've been great. You've done everything that you need to do. You put up with more than you needed to. And then he gives him immortality and brings him to sit at his side. So, you know, I guess the point of that is the father, you know, the mother is inclined to want to make our path easy. How can I soften the path? How can I don't want you to hurt. I don't want it to be difficult, right? You know, mother can be that way. And father says, no, look, I've given you what you need, and now you're on your own. And doesn't leave, is still watching from a distance, is still paying attention. But, you know, you fall and you scrape your knee, and he's going to let you get up and keep running and do it again instead of running over and picking you up and coddling you and kissing your boo-boo like mom would. And that's actually what we really need in order to mature and become adults. So, you know, if Hercules had you know, an archetype that had intervened, a parent that had intervened on his behalf, would he ever have been able to experience his strength, which was just, you know, both physical and metaphorical, you know, strength of spirit, a strength of persistence, and, you know, really become the legend that he was. He wouldn't have been able to do that if the father archetype had not given him that space to do that and then rewarded him in the end.
That's actually a really interesting point, that Hercules' strength did not manifest until he was placed in the path of adversity. So by Zeus away from him, that enabled that to happen. Whereas, as you pointed out, had he been coddled all the way through, he would have been no different to anyone else in the world.
Exactly. And this is where today I think we make this mistake. Parents make this mistake of being too, of not allowing children to have adversity and to overcome it and figure things out.
Yeah, very true. So in your paper, you pointed out that Zeus was absent from all his children with the exception of Dionysus and Athena.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Athena, too, is he's not even aware that he's holding Athena. You know, Dionysus, he is, right? He plucks him out of Semele's womb and puts him in his thigh, whereas he swallows Athena's mother, Metis. He makes, you know, he plays a trick on her, gets her to reduce herself to the size of a fly, and then he swallows her. And Metis, being the goddess of wisdom, then goes, and she's already pregnant, and resides in his head, great metaphor, and, you know, then eventually Zeus has this horrible, terrible headache because the infant is growing and growing and growing, and sure enough, when his head is cracked open, as the legend is told, Hephaestus, you know, takes a steel blade to Zeus's head and he cracks it open, and then miraculously no pain, no healing time. But Athena is born a full adult in full armor, right?
Yes.
So she is with her father. He has been holding her and not even knowing that he is. So that's a kind of interesting thing to unpack as well. But nonetheless, and he even does that because he's afraid of a child usurping his power the same way that he did of Cronos and his father did of his grandfather, that Cronos did to Uranus, right? And so his way of avoiding that was to swallow the mother while she was still pregnant, and that's how we get Athena.
Yeah.
Now,
I find it interesting that all this ties in with your latest newsletter. For anyone listening who hasn't checked it out, Jan produces a regular newsletter, which is really excellent, all on the subject of coming home. So the latest newsletter is titled When You Lose Your Father. Ties in very, very nicely with what we're talking about.
What in particular is resonating with you right now, Tony, as you mentioned that?
Just that the fathers that we have are our connections to the world, and when you actually lose your father or you lose your parents, then you're forced to become far, far more independent. So you either find an inner strength and achieve legendary status like Hercules, or you just wither and die. I can imagine a lot of people just thinking, well, I don't have the strength to go on, and backing out. So the whole thing about the father is that the father can be a crutch, but if you have an inner strength, then by having the father figure withdrawn, either through death or some other reason, then you can actually achieve a far fuller potential than you would otherwise.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the father is rarely a crutch the way that mother is, because mother is so comforting. That's the thing that we never want to leave. Where the father can be the challenge is if he is, or, and again, when I say he, just to pause for a moment, these are archetypes. And so the archetypes are without gender. It is very possible, especially in today's world, that you could have a female in your life, even your birth mother, your mother of origin, act in the father archetypal role, whereas, you know, the male in your life, male adults could be in the mother archetype role. So these are archetypes. But whoever it is that's being that mother archetype that's comforting, that feeds us, that nurtures us, that's what we typically don't want to leave. That the father archetype, if the father archetype has done well, they've taught us these skills, and, you know, specifically what I was thinking as we kind of is that coming off of talking about Athena in the head was this idea of being chieftains, that our fathers are great leaders. They are chieftains. I recently heard this amazing artist, Christian Scott, who spoke about chieftains and his father dying. He was a chieftain, and now he, at 36, is a chieftain. He has to be that chieftain. He has to carry on in the steps of his father. Whereas if the father archetype is abusive or has been oppressive in any way, or that shadow aspect, if the father's tyrannical or so full of themselves that they put down the son or put down the child, that even as a child we say, oh, you're no good. You know, it's the shadow father archetype is the one on the playground at the Little League game, right? Who just gives their child a hard time about not doing better, right? In that case, when the father is gone, where do you go from there? Even when the father's alive, how do you, you just never live up to the approval of the father archetype, and essentially then you never find who you are. And even with all the love and the belief of the mother archetype, it's very difficult to find your footing and go out into the world. Find yourself. So whenever the positive archetype is missing, we're always looking for it to be fulfilled somewhere else. And in terms of the father archetype, you might find that in a coach. You might find that in a teacher. You might find that in some other male figure in your life, typically a male figure. It could be a grandparent, a pastor. I would say even today, my commentary would be even sadly today, but maybe it's always been true. Sometimes that archetype is found in our politicians, right? So we think of, more so in other countries, but that the leader of the nation is the father of the nation, right? And again, if you haven't had a positive father archetype in your life, you might look to a politician to kind of fulfill that role. There you go.
I'm not sure what to think about that one.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack, and I'm not going to say anything. So just bringing everything together, all the thoughts that you have together, what do you think makes a good father figure? And I think that your thoughts could be better. Makes a good father figure.
A good father figure will, first, when we are young, is protective and nurturing, just like the mother archetype can be, right? So when we are very young, father is otherworldly to us. You know, father is that figure that, wow, he's a god. I mean, my dad knows everybody. My dad's stronger than your dad. My dad is, you know, right? We have that sense when we're children that our fathers are omnipotent. And that's a good dad. You know, not that we're scared of them, not that we're going to get the belt or that they're scary. They're not a monster. They're like, wow, they're great. They can do anything. They're mad. They know everything. So that's the first relationship with a good father that we have. And then as we get older, when we're in our adolescent years, is when the father archetype in the positive teaches us skills, will give us, you know, say things like, hey, you know, make sure that you they'll take us out driving with our license, our permit. They'll either say, sit us down and say, these are the birds and the bees, or to the girl, they'll say, hey, only accept this kind of behavior from a guy. They say, get your hair cut. They lay down the law in an effort for us to understand this is the language and these are the rules and the processes by which you can succeed in the outside world. In home, inside the home, yeah, you can grow your hair all the way down to your butt and you can walk around in your pajamas and eat, you know, candy all day. But if you're going to go and live in the world and be an adult, you better get your hair cut. You're going to have to be on time. You're going to have to dress a certain way, and so on and so forth. Hopefully not without crushing our individuality, but these are the things that father teaches us. A traditional gift from father as we are leaving home is to give us a wallet. And what's the purpose of a wallet? To hold money, to hold currency. That's what we need in order to be successful in the world. We need that currency. Well, you got to have a place to put it. Or a father gives you keys to the car. Again, it's that bridge to the outside world. Or a father might give you a suitcase, right? So those are all, or a timepiece, a watch, right? Again, how do you, giving you the tools necessary to be successful in the world. So the positive father is that one that inspires, teaches, instructs us, and so forth. Whereas the negative father is the one that is abusive, says you're not good enough, puts you down, you'll never amount to anything, or you'll never be as good as me. You know, that kind of arrogance and pride, or the full-on aggression, somebody that's an abuser in the house, right? Then also shows the pride and all of that too. So I think those are two pretty clear divisions that we see. And, you know, like even it's still one of my favorite movies. Do you remember It's a Wonderful Life, right? Everybody's seen It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah. And George Bailey, his father is a good man, and George Bailey wants nothing more than to go travel the world. And his dad, you know, is the head of the savings and loans. George Bailey doesn't want to do that. anything but that. He basically says to his father, I would rather die than do what you do, which is heartbreaking to his father. And sure enough, hours later, his dad dies. It's not funny, but that's what happened. Years later, when he is, you know, he thinks he's really going to be able to then take his adventure. Or maybe it's actually even right before his dad dies. Who steps in and gives him the suitcase that's big enough to put all the stickers from different countries? It's what do you call the guy that does drugs, the druggist that he worked for, right? Who became a bit like, you know, always watched out for him, so on and so forth. He's the one that gave him that piece of luggage. So again, that archetype can show up in different ways. And it's not always reserved to just our physical fathers or to just one person.
Yeah. In your paper, you actually provide examples from a number of other contemporary movies, and I was hoping you could discuss some of them briefly. So the ones I was most interested in were Guardians of the Galaxy, Interstellar, The Terminator, Contact, Star Trek Into Darkness, and the Harry Potter franchise. And if we have time, we can talk about some of the others as well. I love the way that you always like to incorporate things from contemporary movies, pop culture and the like, because a lot of people tend to be far more familiar with that than they are with classical mythology.
Yeah. Well, and I think to even take it a step further, we know Pew Research and other, we've found over time, we have moved farther and farther away from organized religion. It's just true. And, you know, whether it's from ancient Greece all the way through Christianity, you know, we are just, there are not as many true believers. And so popular culture has, in essence, become our new religion. If you think about film or movies, you know, movies are kind of our new houses of worship. They were very quiet during the last 2 years due to COVID, but you think about it, movies are sold as this magic, movie magic, right? And we sit in the dark, we give our full attention, we believe whatever we see on the screen, and we basically worship the actors. You know, the actors become stars. Again, it's a celestial kind of thing. And so what film and popular culture does is it's able to carry these archetypes and narratives from religions, from sacred mythologies, into the present. And so we absorb them still, and we are still, you know, still part of our cultural psyche, not necessarily recognizing that they come from all the way back, from the ancient Egyptian religion, ancient Greece, so on and so forth. Marvel in particular, you mentioned several, you know, starting with Guardians of the Galaxy.
Before we get into specifics, can I just interrupt you with just a brief observation? One of the other amazing things about movies is that when times get tough economically and families are on limited budgets, despite the fact that they're going to cut corners everywhere, they will still find money to watch movies because movies provide an escape from current circumstances.
Absolutely.
So I just want to
isn't that fascinating? Because we think of it as escape, right? And yet, even in that escapism, it's really feeding something that we need. Psychically and emotionally, it is speaking to us. And we're just not even conscious of it. Because what it's doing, and so that's what I was going to say about Marvel in particular, I think this is true for the most part, with really good movies. Marvel has created a whole universe, however, that provides every aspect of myth. So Joseph Campbell spoke about the four functions of myth. So how we can really define what a myth or mythology is that it has an origin story, right? Think of every religion, there's an origin story. Where do we come from? How were we created? And then there is the sociological and the the impact of how do we live with each other? What are the mores? What's the, what's right and wrong? Mythology, the stories and mythologies tell us what is right and wrong. How do we live with other people? Mythologies also tell us who we are. I'm a child of God, or, even science is its own mythology because it fills all these functions functions of myth. And so science tells us, oh, well, you are a set of DNA, and this is exactly who you are. And based on your DNA, you will be blah, 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 blah. So every mythology does have a way of telling us who I am individually. Then how do I live with other people? Where did my whole race in the world come from? And then finally, it gives us a sense of awe. There's just a sense of mystery that can't be explained. And you have to suspend rational thinking and just be swept up in the awe of it. So what really goes very closely with religion is the ritual, right? Whether it's, what I would call smells and bells, the music and the incense or the sage or the fire or smoke or whatever it is. Movies have all four of those functions, right? And the last one, that sense of the numinous and the mystery and the awe, is we turn down the lights and we, we're sitting in the glow of the film and we believe everything it makes no sense, There's no way that this or that could happen, whether it's a science fiction film or it's just a family film. You would not have said that at that time. That would have happened earlier, right? But we suspend all that belief. So that is that's what movies give us. Yeah, I agree. So it is really interesting that we continue to go back to them because they're comforting. Again, you kind of think of it as it's almost like a hearth. It's the Hestia's hearth. It's a warmth of sitting around a TV or the movie. That glow. We are sitting in the glow of it. Anyway, you brought up some really great films. I think the oldest of those was The Terminator. For anybody remembers The Terminator, got to be of a certain age.
I'm old enough to.
Me too. We find out in the very first one, the main character is John Connor, but it's John Connor's father came from the future. So then someone comes back to protect him, that's the Terminator, so that John Connor can live long enough to go into the future. And what does he do in the future? This is what kills me. I love this. He basically is a monster slayer, right? He's supposed to get rid of the bad and the evil. So you see how over and over again from these sacred mythologies, these religions, into movie, into present time, the same stories repeat themselves. What was the other one? Contact. I love Contact because I think that was the first time that I was really conscious of the name of the primary character. Played by Jodie Foster. It's Ellie Arroway, and her father. She's again born of a mother who's dead. Her mother died in childbirth. So she's got this great dad who teaches her all about the stars. And in fact, they are looking through a telescope when he has a heart attack and dies. And she's all like 10 years old, but her name is Arroway. I mean, again, something that takes flight, right? and her dad looking at the stars. There's your connection to the celestial father. And so, of course, then her whole life is about astronomy, and she makes contact with some other planet or, you know, some other beings. They tell her to build this contraption to come visit. She gets to be the one to go on that trip, and the being that approaches her is her father. Turns out to be her father. In the end, you know, we discover that it's not really her dad. You know, the celestial being, the alien being, whatever you call it, says, no, I'm only coming in the form of your father so that you would be comfortable. But still, there you are. You know, her whole life work has been in search of that contact with her father again, the father in the sky. And then there's Interstellar. Same kind of thing happens.
Another thing about contact, and I don't think that Arroway actually refers to this, but there's always a possibility. If you work with the Kabbalah, and the central glyph in the Kabbalah is the Tree of Life, and if your spirituality involves ascending up the Tree of Life, there is what is known as the Path of the Arrow, which starts at the bottom in Malkuth, comes up to Yesod, up to Tiferet, and then up to Kether. It's just a path straight up the middle of the Tree of Life. It's also known as the Path of the Sage.
That's beautiful, Tony.
Just floating, throwing it out there. I mean, you never know.
That's beautiful. Well, I think that all these things, it's so brilliant. I mean, I always wonder, if anybody knows, anybody that works in the movies who can answer this question, I would just let me know. Because I always think it is fascinating to me how many layers of meaning that there always are. And I wonder, I'm sure that there's some consciousness around some of these things, right? But it must be impossible. It can't all be planned. That who's ever writing the script or directing or, you know, doing costumes, they can't possibly think of all the symbolism, right? Which then says to me, you know, that's how archetypes work. They just show up, and it's not even our conscious thought. So whether or not, again, anyone on the film knew about the Kabbalah or not, and the arrow, that's a great connection. I love that you brought that up.
You know, sometimes things seem to be deliberate, like going back to Star Wars, the central villain is Darth Vader. And if you think of Darth is the name of the Sephiroth, which is in this. He crossed the Dark Mother. So it almost seems to be, you know, a very deliberate reference to the Abyss. And then you look at the first Matrix movie, the Wachowski brothers, who are now, well, they've transitioned, immediately incorporated every esoteric reference they could think of into the Matrix. It's an incredibly spiritual movie. So sometimes these are deliberate, and I think that even if they're not deliberate, they may well be subconscious.
I agree. And I think that's true not only in film, but it's true. I know that it's true in all other forms of art. You know, Bob Dylan will say, hey, I was just writing a song. And yet, you know, you can have a million people in the world go, oh, my goodness, when you wrote this, when you wrote Blown in the Wind, it also meant this, this, and then they can find all this other symbolism. Same true of a poem, right, or a story. Repeatedly, artists and writers and musicians are saying, yeah, I was thinking something, but I wasn't thinking all of that. But that's how the archetypes move through us. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Guardian of the Galaxy, so I know we're running short, so I do want to say, I know this is, you know, kind of an older movie now. But in particular, why I love it is because there's more than one. So in the very first one, again, going back to Arroway, in this film, Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, our main character, our hero is Peter Quill. Same thing, feather. Earth Mother, very beginning, she is dying of cancer. She says to her son, you're so much like your father. Your father was an angel. So right away we know, father did not come from Earth. He wasn't human. And then finally at the very end of the film, he has this whole kind of standoff with this evil guy, Thanos, who then shows up in the other Marvel movies. Thanos is the shadow father archetype. He is the egomaniac. He's so arrogant that he believes he knows what's best for all of humanity. He has two daughters that he is absolutely abusive to, and they both want to kill him. Right there, that'll tell you it's not a positive father. So, and at the end, the way that Peter is able to kind of save the world is he's able to hold on to something that you could only hold if you were divine. And in the end, it's revealed that blood test was done on him, and sure, his mother was from Earth, but his father had to be from another ancient source that we never knew. So there you go. That's how it ends. And but what has been running through his whole life is this idea of where's my dad? And this group of ragamuffins had picked him up from Earth when his mom died and were supposed to deliver him to his dad, but never did. And the leader of those ragamuffins, we'll call them, is Yondu. And it's in the second film that we find out why this Yondu never delivered him to his father. And he actually was trying to protect him from his own father. In the second film, Peter Quill gets to meet his father. And he's so excited at first. But his father's name, turns out, is Ego. E-G-O. That's his father's name. Right there, you know, we're going to have a problem. And, you know, so in the end, you know, he does finally get to meet his father, but he has already matured enough in the first film so that even when he meets his father and then he is able to be enough of a mature adult because this ragamuffin guy, Yondu, in the most bizarre way, had already been a kind of weird archetypal father to him, that eventually he's not completely sucked into the drama of his father. He's able to see that his father is not a good father, whereas Yondu is. And Yondu does end up giving his life for Peter to go on living and everybody else to go on living. And then the bad father is destroyed. So, yeah, if you haven't seen any of the Guardians of the Galaxy, probably none of that made sense to you. But if you watch it, maybe you'll pick up on it.
No, I have watched them, and I've thoroughly enjoyed them. In your paper, you also talked about the significance of the Walk on the Tape. You, Hercules, and I are old enough to remember what Walkmans are. Younger listeners or viewers, I should say, probably won't be. So you talked about how important that was to the plot.
Yeah. Why that is. So, again, what happens right before we see at the beginning of the film that the very young, like 9-year-old or 7-year-old Peter Quill, it has a Walkman on and he's listening to these songs on cassette tape. And they turn out to be his mother's favorite songs. And when his mother, right before she dies in the hospital room, she hands him a little box. And she says, open this when I'm gone, when I'm gone. and it's immediately put in his backpack, and right after that, he gets sucked off of Earth by this Yondu and, you know, the ragamuffins. And he never, ever, it turns out to be a mixtape, and he cannot bring himself to listen to it. Instead, he continues to listen to this other cassette tape, which all of us familiar with Walkmans know would never have lasted. That tape and torn apart and stuck and all of that. Yeah. But the significance of it is that mom, just like dad, but in a different way, mother will always nurture us. So if we have that good archetypal mother role in our life, we are given some sort of sustenance from the mother that continues to feed us even when we've left home. Whether it's the wisdom, be kind to others, or it's a memory of her kissing our boo-boo, or really it's her having held us and loved us, and we knew our mother's love was always with us, that when we are away from home, we still have that sustenance that keeps us going emotionally. And that is what this second mixtape is from his mother, that he finally only opens in the second film when he has faced his father. And now he's ready for that. But in the first film, what he cannot let go of is that first mixtape that had also come from his mother. Yeah.
You also, in your paper, came up with some really interesting ideas about Groot, the uber adorable Groot in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, isn't he adorable?
I have to interrupt. We have 3.5 minutes left.
Okay. Well, for anyone, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but in Guardians of the Galaxy, it's the very first one. They get themselves, I'm sure you could not have lived on this planet and not seen Groot, the little kind of sentient tree-like character, who only repeatedly says, "I am Groot, I am Groot." Well, yes. In the end, there is this, they're in a bad situation. They're going to blow up on this spacecraft. And what Groot does, Groot then does embody the mother archetype by growing so much. All these branches grow out that Groot is able to hold the entire, you know, cluster of these friends into a like a ball, and provides the protection, sacrificing. I'm going to say him, genderless or herself. So he is what actually gets destroyed when they crash, but he is able to protect the rest of them, and they are not hurt because he has created this kind of barrier around them. But then actually he does regenerate. He slowly, you know, comes back to life in the second movie and so on. But, yeah, so Groot is that mother archetype, the positive mother who will sacrifice herself, which, since you mentioned findinghome.substack.com, my newsletter on Substack, Finding Home, I actually wrote about that on Mother's Day. The original purpose of Mother's Day wasn't really to celebrate mom as being mom. It was to celebrate women and how much women sacrifice for the world.
We now have a minute till they cut us off.
Okay, so Jem, why is all this important? Contact details so people can get more information. Ultra quick summary.
I can't even do a summary, but definitely you can contact me at findinghome@substack.com. You can go to Finding Home on Substack. .com and read my newsletter there and my posts, and otherwise you can probably find me through Tony or Hercules. Thank you both for having me tonight and for hosting this. This was fun.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's a pleasure.
And again, you were awesome.
Always. Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you. And thank you for, see, it always takes a team. My brain is small. It helps to have other people know the answers to things. Yeah.
It is yeah. Vast from what I've experienced.
You're kind. All right. Well, I look forward to, I hope we get to do this again in a couple months, and many, many blessings to both of you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I hope
you
so too.
Well, thanks to all those who tuned in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures.